The Fern Line is supported by the Alaska Rock Gym, providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995. Alaska Rock Gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of boulder terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms. Stop by anytime to take a tour of the facility or check out the Alaska Rock Gym online at alaskarockgym.com. The Fern Line is also supported by the Moose's Tooth Pub and Pizzeria. Moose's Tooth has been a hub of the Anchorage community since 1996, offering a great selection of mouth-watering pizzas and salads, award-winning handcrafted beers, and incredible live concerts. To peruse the menu or find out more about upcoming live events, check the Moose's Tooth out online at moosestooth.net. All right, let's get to the show. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On season two, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right. Well, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. I hope you're all doing well and settling into winter, whether you're sharpening your ice tools and crampons for a season of ice climbing or trading in the tools for a few months of carefree desert living. Before we dive in today, I just want to share an excerpt from an email I recently received, and this comes from Elaine Morin. Evan, you mentioned that you enjoy getting emails from listeners, and it reminded me that I've always been semi-mystified by the phrase you use in your introduction, folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles. It strikes me that I don't quite know what you mean by this, and I really would love to know. I feel that if I were to ask 10 people how they define a full-value lifestyle, they'd all provide 10 radically different answers. So this is my question. How do you define a full-value lifestyle? Well, Elaine, that's a great question, and I do have an answer. But before I do that, I'd like to use Elaine's question as an opportunity for all of you Fernline listeners out there to share how you define what it means to live a full-value lifestyle. So here's what I want to do. For anyone that wants to participate, record a 15 to 20 second recording of yourself describing what a full value lifestyle means to you. You can record this on your phone or any other gadget that you have that can give you an MP3 or an MP4 file. And when you're done, send me an email with the recording attached to thefernline@gmail.com. And hopefully I'll receive a bunch of these in the next month, and I will share these on a Fernline episode. Again, you can send your recording to thefernline@gmail.com. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or your inverted, upside-down, no-hands rest, and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line. If you're a climber who consumes climbing-related media like writing or magazines, video or podcasts, well, the chances are you've heard of Kathy Carlo. Kathy is the creative force behind For the Love of Climbing, an entertaining and insightful blog that combines honest, to-the-point writing about life on and off the walls, mixed with a good dose of self-deprecating humor. I'd heard of Kathy's renowned blog probably sometime in 2017, and although I perused some of her stories and photos, I have to admit, I never really took the time to sit down and actually delve into her work. But when I heard she was starting a new podcast, I eagerly awaited her first episode. And let's just say, I was not let down. For me, listening to Kathy's podcast for the first time was an emotional gut punch that had me laughing one minute, tearing up the next, and at the end of it all, feeling astonished at the level of creativity and production she put into it. It's a true lesson in the power of audio. That's why I was stoked to connect with Kathy a few months ago when she came through Alaska on assignment with her job with No Man's Land Film Festival. We got to sit down for an engaging conversation about the ups and downs of life on the road, how she first started writing a blog, and how that eventually led to her starting a podcast. But we went back even farther than that, and we started our conversation by talking about Kathy's early experiences in the tight-knit New York climbing scene.
I didn't know how to rock climb, and I only kind of knew how to ice climb. So I actually wound up taking a guided class with EMS up in the Catskills, and then somebody told me about the Gunks. And so I started climbing there. I met some people at a local gym, and they, for some reason, were willing to take somebody who knew nothing about rock climbing out. And I would say maybe a total of 3 or 4 days in, and I was pretty convinced that I could do what they were doing. Like, yeah. They were leading up things, and I just had this need to feel like I was a self-sufficient person, I guess. So, yeah.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of climbers, they have an experience, and it's almost like a light bulb moment where they're like, this is what I'm going to do. Did you have that experience?
I can't say there was a specific moment other than I remember the feeling, you know, like I don't remember the climb. I can't remember all the details of the day, but I remember that feeling and of doing something new. And it was just different from anything else I'd ever done before.
So when you started climbing, how did your life change after that?
Well, I started working at a gear shop because I didn't know anybody or anything about climbing. And I figured that would probably be a great way to find a community a little bit. So I started working at a gear shop, which is kind of a funny thought, thinking about a gear shop in the middle of Manhattan, you know, in the middle of Soho. But, you know, it's kind of this hub, and I feel like everybody at some point in their lives, they travel to New York, and you meet so many climbers from all these different areas, and, you know, they would just tell me stories about places, you know, some local, some a little bit of a drive, and I just started going there. And I mean, you know, sometimes I had a friend or a point of contact, but sometimes I would just show up with like a Tupperware of cookies. And I'd be like, hey, will you climb with me? And so I spent the first like 3 years or so just driving up and down the East Coast, going to all these places, meeting all these new people. And just really, you know, I was so engrossed with the whole thing. Like nothing else mattered. Like right. I didn't think about money. Like I just thought about making enough money to get the gas to go to the place, you know?
It sounds like you were kind of a dirtbag climber. It's like, it seems like climbing is what was important to you and what you were wanting to spend your time doing.
I would consider myself a dirtbag climber, but at the same time, I mean, does a dirtbag climber live in New York City where rent Maybe. Is like $1 million for, you know, for just breathing the air on the corner of the street? I don't know. I mean, and it was an interesting juxtaposition to be paying so much money in rent and then also just being as frugal as possible when I was outside of the city limits, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was an interesting time in my life.
What was the, I'm just kind of curious, like what was the climbing community like in New York or the scene that you were hanging out with at that time?
So the climbing community in New York is probably one of the most tight-knit communities I've ever experienced. And I don't know if it's because I started climbing there. And so, you know, there's like a little bit of loyalty, of course, and that sort of thing to the place that you started climbing in. But I've never met a community where there was such a mishmash of different personalities, and careers and just everything, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. you would have, I guess, just dirtbags like me who didn't really have a career path or anything going on, just climbing, and that was it, you know, working part-time jobs here and there, just trying to make money. And then there were, you know, I had friends who were doctors and lawyers and weekend warriors because, you know, they had full-time jobs and families. And it was so cool to have so many different walks of life come together in like one gym setting or, you know, up in the gunks or something like that. And that one connector that, you know, they just love climbing as much as you did.
One of the things that I've heard you say is there was a point in time where you're like, well, I wanted to start this blog to let my mom know that I was still alive. Can you talk about that period in your life?
In all the years that I spent living in Brooklyn and, you know, and I started exploring the climbing world, I definitely stopped calling home as often as I could have. And I always felt really guilty about that too. And I mean, and it's the same for a lot of friends that I've had over the years who are, as I like to call them, civilians. I love my non-climbing friends, but I definitely don't reach out to them as often. And so my family, you know, by default, they kind of fell under that category. I felt like I couldn't really explain to my mom what it was I was doing just through a phone call. And so when I started writing the blog, I immediately, she was the first person I shared it with. And I was just like, you know, this is just to kind of give you a glimpse into the world that I'm living in now. And this is what I'm doing. And just so you know, if I don't call you, you can read the blog and you know,
right.
there's an update on my life there. Yeah. So I'm alive.
So what was the instigator for you starting to write a blog?
I always wanted to be a writer, but it was nothing that I pursued. I didn't think that I ever would or could. I remember in the third grade, actually, I told my mom that I was going to be the Great American Author, and I convinced her to buy me a laptop in the third grade. I did not write the Great American Novel, by the way. But I remember one weekend I had off, and usually when I had like 3 or 4 days off when I was living in New York, I would just get in the car and go. And so I feel like that's like a very typical thing for people who live in cities. You know, if you have even just a 2-day weekend, you will drive 8 hours to get somewhere so you can go climb and get back in time for work on Monday. So I remember I had this little patch of days off, and I actually was feeling, I don't know, just oddly content, I guess. I mean, it was a beautiful day. I think it was sometime in the summer, and I could have gone up to the gunks, and I opted not to. And I remember thinking that I would just sit down and write about it. I was just saying that it was okay to have a balance between the climbing life and, you know, everything else, which, you know, I really did believe then, and I really do believe now. But I've definitely spent a lot of years kind of just driving schizophrenically all around the country trying to figure that out firsthand. Yeah. But yeah, that was kind of the whole beginning, I guess, of writing the blog.
So did you have any like goals or aspirations for the blog when you started it? Or was it kind of something that was open-ended?
It was totally open-ended. You know, I wasn't on a schedule. I didn't work with companies then. It was just because I really enjoyed writing and sharing, you know, just some of the things that I was doing. Because it felt important. It felt important because it felt important to me, you know, for other people to kind of to read what I was writing. I don't really know. I didn't really have a real agenda, I guess.
Yeah.
I like writing stories and I like sharing them. And I think that's all I was doing for like the first year or so.
So like at what point in time with the blog did you maybe realize that people were reading it and paying attention and maybe having reactions to it?
I would say I started it in June, and I would say probably by that winter, maybe like December, January, I wound up quitting my job. I kind of just got in my car and drove west. And I think it was a big move for me. And I think that other people saw that as a brave thing as well. Right. And they wanted to kind of follow along and just see what would happen to Kathy.
So you were documenting that?
In a way, yeah. I just kind of fully embraced the dirtbag life for a full year. And, you know, I was making a little bit of money through writing and a little bit, you know, other ways. But mostly I was just climbing and figuring it out. And everybody saw that as such an amazing thing, right? You're living the dirtbag dream. You get to climb every day. And I think as the time went on, I increasingly became just more and more depressed. I don't know. It's kind of this interesting thing, right? Where people who do have to work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, they think, you know, that's what I'd be you know, I'd love to go do. And there I was with that life, and I didn't want it. Like, I just wanted more structure and I wanted more stability. And I think that that was the whole point. And like, selling everything I owned and leaving New York City, it was to kind of restructure my entire life from the ground up. And I didn't know what that was going to look like. So yeah, I mean, that was definitely what that year was for me. I mean, I traveled to a lot of places and I climbed a lot of awesome things. And, you know, I think I pushed myself mentally and physically, but I think it was always about rebuilding. When you do that, when you restructure your life from the ground up, you can literally start anywhere you want. Yeah. So that was kind of exciting.
If you ever get to meet Kathy in person, one of the first things you'll notice is her upbeat demeanor. Maybe it's her legendary coffee intake, which sometimes tops out at 6 Americanos a day. Or perhaps it's her pure enthusiasm for climbing, coupled with her witty sense of humor. Either way, she's a lot of fun to be around. But Kathy will be the first person to tell you that life isn't always easy. And maybe it's her willingness to talk about the imperfections of life that have garnered her an ever-growing audience. I asked Kathy to talk about a challenging experience that she's faced in her life, how she dealt with it at the time, and what she learned moving forward.
Climber that I had known previously from New York called me up, and he had this trip planned and he needed a team of three, and I think that his third had actually backed out. And so he called me up and he said, "You're the only person that I could think of that likes to suffer that much," which is kind of a funny way to sell somebody on something. But you know, I'd never done a big wall before, and I definitely wanted to. I wanted to learn. Like, that was, you know, part of the reason why I wound up settling in Colorado is because I wanted to climb more big things, and I wanted to learn how to alpine climb. And my initial reaction was no. I said, you know, I don't know how to do this, and I feel like learning how to big wall climb while trying to establish an FA just seems like a bad idea. Yeah. So I declined, but then I was told that you can teach anybody how to do anything, but you can't teach attitude. And so I agreed, because I went in with the understanding that, you know, I would be shown what to do and how to do it. And I guess in a sense be taken care of. So I had that like blanket of security, and there was no way for me to know at that time how over my head I was getting. And yeah, that was the worst 4 weeks of my life. That's what I tell people.
Yeah. What were some of the things that were hard about the trip, or, you know, whatever you feel comfortable sharing about that?
You know, it started off fine. You know, we were all kind of in this place of anticipation, and it very quickly became apparent that I was not the right person for this objective. You know, you can't teach somebody how to climb a big wall and establish a route at the same time. It's too much. Like, I didn't have the bandwidth at that time. And it was really physically brutal. Like, yeah. For instance, we didn't have the adapter that you would need for a gas canister to be able to make food on a wall. And so we never stayed on the wall.
It's kind of a big deal.
It's kind of a big deal. I really like coffee. I will not start my day without coffee. And I think every person there agreed with me. And so instead of having that option, we jugged the route every single day.
Wow.
And I mean, as the days went on, it only became, you know, longer and harder. And I'd never jugged before. Like, I don't know if you've ever ascended a line before.
Oh yeah.
It's exhausting.
Yeah. There's a real art to it.
There really is. Yeah. And I had never done it before. And I was just so ill prepared. And I mean, I go into things with this really positive attitude. I always tell myself, you know, it's okay if you don't know how to do it, you know, because it's all a part of the learning process. But that wasn't true for this trip.
Yeah.
And I mean, even bolting routes, like I'd never bolted a route before. I could barely hold a drill above my head. It was, you know, it was just physically demanding and I was not prepared for it. And I took all the blame for sure. I definitely, at that time, I called myself a failure and, you know, and I just hated myself because there was this thing that I couldn't, no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't be successful at. And at the very end of it, you know, I was left behind, and that was really hard. You know, waiting on the ground for, you know, several, I forget how long it was, but at least a day and a night. I mean, it's kind of like being in prison. You know, you're by yourself. You're completely isolated, and you just, you know, thinking about all the things that you could have done right, and all the things that you definitely did wrong. And you know, I definitely left that entire experience thinking I'm never gonna climb again. And that was the first time in my entire life that I'd ever felt that way about climbing. It was something that brought me so much joy. And at that moment, and for a long time after that, it did the opposite. Wow. So yeah.
Wow, it sounds like that was like pretty intense and really hard.
That was
like,
Africa.
Yeah, was physically and like psychologically and emotionally.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's worth being mentioned, like, I wasn't a newbie at, you know, like multi-pitch climbing. I've done a ton of stuff, you know, in different climbing areas with partners, big stuff, things that were very physically demanding. I think that just being totally out of my element in another country, I mean, this isn't like doing a big wall in like Zion National Park. This is doing a big wall in the middle of a jungle where, I mean, it's an hour plus approach in and you have to think about snakes and, you know, nobody speaks the same language as you. And you're also the only female climber on the team. I think that made a huge difference. I remember the first time I actually spoke with another woman who was a local in the plantation. And she told me she had no idea how I could be the only woman on the team and not feel alone. And I just cried. I just cried for like 20 minutes, wow. You know?
So what, like, how did that trip end for you?
So, like I said, I got left behind. I wasn't allowed to be on the route, to have anything to do with the route in the end. There was like a film crew there and, you know, that sort of thing, and they documented it. So it was interesting to have the trip end and, you know, in a series of high fives and, you know, great success for some of the team members. And then for me, like my whole world was shattered. Wow. And I remember saying goodbye at the airport, and the team leader, I said to him, you know, thank you for giving me an experience that gave me thicker skin. And he looked at me and he said, are you going to go back to nannying? I was a nanny in Colorado. Because you should. And I got on the plane and I mean, I was pretty much at that point ready to just sell all my gear and never climb another thing again. I didn't think I deserved it. I didn't think I was worth it. There were a ton of things going on at the time. Like the guy that I had been seeing, he broke up with me when I got back. I had moved out of my apartment before I left for this trip, so I didn't have a home anymore. And so, you know, it took a couple of weeks, probably longer. I was pretty depressed. I didn't really know what I was doing. And I think the entirety of my life, I'd never really known what I was doing. I'm definitely the kind of person who just, I will ride one wave into the next one and just, you know, take things as far as I can and see where they'll go. And this was the first time in my life. I had no idea what was going to happen next. And that really scared me. And it's a pretty funny story. I was sitting on a sidewalk curb and having a complete breakdown about this whole thing. And a woman had come up to me and she just sat with me and she brought me tissues. And when I could finally form a cohesive sentence, she told me that she was a psychiatrist. And I'm just like, how does that even happen? How do you have your first panic attack ever? And the universe is just like, well, here you go. Like, you can have therapy right now.
sitting here late at night, wondering where you might be. Probably just drinking with your friends. Lord, there was a life that nearly killed me. Why shouldn't you? But why couldn't you? Give me a call. Call me right now. Lord, there was a couple of nights.
You know, sometimes life isn't all that straightforward. We can make all the right plans, prepare ourselves as best we can, and follow the roadmap laid out in front of us, only to come out the other side wondering, what the hell just happened? Luckily for Kathy, she's found multiple avenues beyond climbing that help her process her experiences in life. And perhaps out of all those avenues, the most important is writing.
Baby, come home. Baby, come home. Right now. I need you for the rest of my life. Baby, come home. Baby, come home. Right now.
I mean, Africa wrecked me. It definitely flipped my entire world upside down. And I didn't know what to do, so I started to write about it. And the more that I wrote about it, the better I started feeling, obviously. It was really cathartic. And I didn't share any of this. I didn't tell anybody. You know, I came back from Africa, and people knew that I was there from social media, and they would ask me all the time, how was the trip? And I was like, you know, I was like, it was fine. And that was it. I didn't tell anybody that, you know, I dubbed myself a failure, that, you know, I was super depressed and living in my car and not happy about it for the first time. And so I started writing about it, and then I wound up with a piece that I called Do Not Go Outside to Cry. And that was really huge, not just for me, but I think it was really big for a lot of other women who could relate to all of the things that I was thinking and feeling. How, you know, if you're going through a hard time and you are on a climbing trip or an expedition or, you know, in any kind of capacity in the outdoor world, that if you're having a hard time, you can't share it with others. That you have to kind of go find a corner, a quiet corner by yourself, or leave the room, you know, to express that, to cry, let it out. And I think that once I wrote that and once I published it and people started responding to it, I started to feel less alone. And I think that it was super empowering. And it was such a comfort to know that, you know, it's not just me who feels this way. So I think that's how it started to get a little bit better. Yeah.
Do you consider yourself a writer?
I didn't for a really long time. But this year, I started introducing myself as Kathy Carlo, freelance writer.
Okay. So what did it take for you to get to that point in your mind?
So I wrote a personal blog, but, you know, I wasn't making a living off of it. And so it was hard for me to tell people that that's what I did, because it's not what I did for a living. And then the first piece that I ever had published outside of an online publication or anything like that, the first piece that I ever had published in print, it was actually with The Climbing Zine. And that's a publication based out of Colorado. And I worked with Luke Mihal, and he really validated me as a writer. And I love working with them. He takes a whole collection of stories from writers and climbers, and he turns it into this really meaningful thing. And I think that being a part of that, kind of like a collective storytelling platform, it really made me start to feel I could call myself a writer now.
Right. How much writing freelance work are you doing separate from the blog? I mean, like, what would this next year look like for you as far as doing freelance writing?
Honestly, probably not a ton, because just new projects, right, you know, kind of on the horizon and that sort of thing. And just realizing how time invasive it all is.
Writing takes a lot of work.
And writing's a lot of work. Yeah. I just this past spring, I had my first piece published in Alpinist, which was huge for me. but it took months. And I don't know if I have the bandwidth to go through that process again. I mean, you know, I say that now, but if the right opportunity came along, I would definitely, you know, I would be committed. But right now I don't see a lot of it. It's also not my full-time job. So, you know, gotta.
Yeah. What's your favorite part about writing?
I think that I really have learned to appreciate the process because I am definitely guilty of always wanting that instant gratification. I want to see the end result. And sometimes I don't want to put the work in. And in the end, I always put the work in, and especially with my writing and being able to sit with a blank piece of paper or a blank document in front of me and watching that whole thing evolve and going back and deleting everything and starting all over again. And then your hard drive crashes and then you have to start all over again after that.
Just you saying that makes me want to cry.
Yeah, oh, God. True story.
Oh, man. How do you navigate through the hard part of writing? Like, basically, where you have to do the work and there's no way around it. Like, what does that look like for you?
A lot of coffee and me banging my head on a desk. Like I was saying, it doesn't come that easily to me until, I guess, once I kind of get a grasp on what I'm trying to convey to other people, like what that message is. Mm-hmm. I think then it gets a lot easier and then the words definitely start to come. Yeah. So I don't know. Sometimes you write and you're just mindlessly doing it and it's just very cathartic and you're just, you know, kind of looking for a release almost, but there's no, you know, structure to it. But if I give myself that structure and I have this message, which I mean, I feel like all of my pieces, there's a very particular message that I'm trying to get across to people. And then it starts to become a little bit more fluid, I think.
What's the average amount of time like you would spend on like a blog piece?
On a regular blog piece, I don't know, maybe like an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. But if it's something that I really care about, like I've written a couple of pieces that I sat back and I looked at it and I thought this could be really good. Like this could get, you know, a lot of outreach. Like people will care about this piece and that could take days. Yeah.
Have you ever thought about writing a book?
I've thought about it. Actually, funny story. I told my climbing partner, my ice climbing partner back in the winter, I said, "Hey, Skip, I'm thinking about starting a podcast." And he said, "Are you sure you want to do that? Do you like the sound of your voice?" And then he told me I should write a book. Which he meant with, you know, the greatest intention. He's actually a professor and he offered to help me edit it and that sort of thing. So it was super, super sweet and meaningful. And I have that in the back of my brain. And I think I would like to. I think maybe I don't have the story yet. So like maybe it hasn't happened yet.
Who are some writers out there right now who are inspiring to you?
Oh, man. Writers who are inspiring to me. I would say Luke Mihal from The Climbing Zine. He's definitely at the top of my list. Like, he's just one of those writers who writes from his heart and he just doesn't give a fuck. He's just gonna let it all out. And it's, I don't know, this beautiful, messy jumble of words. It makes sense. Like, it's very relatable. So yeah, definitely Luke Mihal. He's got a true way with words. And most recently, Chris Kalman. I just picked up his book and I met him at OR for the first time. So that was really special. And I told him that, you know, his words are just, I don't know, he's very inspiring. And I really liked his personality. And I love the work that he's doing. So I think those are two writers right now.
She was a girl from the heart of the land. She was beautiful with a mountain tan. She was lost in the country, lost in a plan. She was gone.
One of the coolest parts of doing this podcast are all the new connections and friendships I've made. And Kathy is a good example of that. I mean, I've only spent a few hours hanging out with her, but because we both do creative things, there's an added bond between us. I guess you could say we're podcast buddies.
Coeur d'Alene, she was gone. To California, yeah, she was gone.
I asked asked Kathy to talk about her new podcast, For the Love of Climbing, where the inspiration to start it came from, and what her goals are as things progress.
Heard about her here and I heard about her there. She played it up like she didn't even care. She packed her bags with room to spare. She was gone. She was gone. Ketchikan, she was gone.
I was writing an essay and I was looking for a quote from somebody, and I reached out to Mary Harlan, who is a climber based out of Carbondale, Colorado. And we wound up talking on the phone. It kind of turned into this interview, which I wasn't really expecting. Like, that was not my intention. And at the end of it, she told me that I should start a podcast. And I laughed and I was like, I don't really like the way my voice sounds. And, you know, that's not a thing that I would ever do. And she kept pushing it. Oh, there it was, this tiny little seed that lived in my brain. And I think I mentioned it once to my boyfriend, and he got me a microphone for my birthday last September. And I was so touched that he remembered this one thing that I said one time in passing. And then I thought, oh, now I have to do this. So yeah, that was kind of the start of it, I guess. And then I sat on the idea for a little bit longer because I didn't know what kind of podcast I wanted to create. I didn't know what I wanted it to be yet. And I know that as far as climbing media goes, I mean, there's so many different podcasts out there right now. There's, you know, the Fernline, there's the Normocast. I mean, there's just a whole plethora of them. Yeah. And I wanted to do something different, but I still didn't know how yet. Yeah. And I started thinking about my blog and how I was taking all of my own personal stories and experiences and writing about them. And it occurred to me that I should do that with this podcast. I should take other people's stories and experiences and give them a platform. Because in my mind, I just don't see that being done in the podcast world quite like this. So yeah, hopefully I'm filling a gap. I don't know yet.
Yeah, well, I think you definitely are. And it was interesting because before I had listened to your podcast, you know, I saw your angle, like you just kind of come out and say this is not a climbing podcast, which is great because you're kind of making a statement but just by doing that. But what I realized in listening to the first episode and kind of the promo episode that you did is you're talking to people about their lives and their experiences, and they happen to be people who are woven in and out and throughout the climbing community.
It's funny because Chris Kalman, actually, he called me after I released the trailer to talk about it. And he's been super supportive, and he gave me some advice, and he was like, you know, don't go advertising it necessarily as not a climbing podcast. If it is, he's like, you know, I've definitely done that in my writing. And, you know, he said, you're definitely going to lose some people. And I thought about it, and I continued to promote it as not a climbing podcast because I think ultimately it isn't. I mean, it is and it isn't, right? Yeah. It's hard to explain that to people unless you've actually listened to it.
Yeah. You notice right off the bat in your podcast that you're addressing and talking to people about intense things. You're giving people an avenue to be really open, to be honest, to like talk about things that have happened to them or feelings that they have. Or what's your experience been so far with, you know, are people willing to be open and talk, or do you have to pull stuff out of people, or is it kind of a mixed bag?
I would say it's pretty mixed, but when I first had this vision for the trailer and what I wanted to do with it, I wanted to take a sample, just like a ton of different voices, no names, and just like a little bit about each person's experience and kind of stitch it all together. I put a bunch of calls out like on Facebook, on Instagram, and I am still going through sound bites. I have over 300 of them. So, I mean, a lot of people said, no, I can't do that. I don't feel comfortable, but over 300 people said, yeah, like I have a story to tell and I want to give it to you. And I want people to hear it. So yeah, I thought that was pretty powerful.
What's your short-term goal with the podcast? And I get, say, in the first year, like, what are some goals you have for the podcast?
Make $1 million.
Right.
I think my short-term goal, at least for the year, is to just get this out there. I know that a lot of people have started to listen to it, which has been amazing. It's had such good reception, and I'm so grateful for everybody who's been sharing it and talking about it. But I wanted to gain more traction, and I want people to understand, I guess, the whole platform. Like, I'm not trying to spray. I'm interested in taking people's stories and elevating them.
What's been the most challenging part for you?
I kind of look forward to the editing. I also dread it, and I look forward to it at the same time because of all the, you know, the things that you need to take out. And I mean, I've had babies in the background. I've had pen clicks. You know, I haven't come up with a perfect formula yet for any of this. So that is a little tedious, but I really look forward to it because, you know, I have this whole story and I get to kind of take it apart and put it back together the way that I'm envisioning it. And so to me, I mean, I'm a writer, so I like to kind of write that narrative, and then I have this amazing, you know, content, this gift that this, you know, the interviewee will give me. And to me, it's just like any kind of writing project, you know.
How many hours did you spend producing that first episode?
Well, I started it in April.
It's August 19th today, or the 20th. It's August 19th or 20th, so 6 months.
Yeah. Okay. But in my defense, if you've heard the first episode, it's a tough one. And
yeah, absolutely.
I would go weeks at a time with just looking at it on my desktop, and I didn't touch it. I mean, I think the interview itself was 3 hours long.
Wow.
We took a lot of breaks. And, you know, just kind of, you know, talk about other things and kind of lighten the mood and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, I would sit in coffee shops and I would be listening to the story or researching a statistic, and I would just start crying. Like, it was so hard to not be emotional during that process. And I think I waver between that, and sometimes I just shut it off completely. And I think that you have to. I think if, you know, you work in certain fields, like if you're a social worker or you work, you know, you become desensitized with certain professions.
Oh, right.
And I think that must be what it must feel like, right? Where you hear the words, but you're just not affected by them at all. And I would waver between that and, you know, just totally shutting it off.
So what's the plan for releasing episodes? How many are, like, how often are you going to release them?
So right now they will be released every 15th of the month. So just one a month right now. Just like I said, until I can kind of figure out a more perfect formula for everything. And
I think that's good. I mean, I think always a less is more approach is better, especially if you are putting a high premium on craft and quality.
Yeah, definitely.
Which you definitely are with your podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I thought about that a lot with my blog. I used to follow a pretty strict, all, you know, self-imposed, of course, schedule. You know, every Tuesday I'm going to come out with an essay, with an article. And I think that it does. It takes away a little bit from the content. And I'd rather put out one really well-produced episode than like some so-so ones every month. So
that's a good call. I'm going to relate to you a little bit. The first season of The Fern Line was, I look back on it now, and it was primarily about alpinists climbing in Alaska, primarily. And I was kind of going back and talking to a lot of people who had been like kind of my alpine heroes when I was a young alpinist. So I was talking to a lot of old school climbers and stuff. But it's interesting because listening back, like, a lot of those conversations were pretty deep and pretty intense. And I think what I have realized is this second season has been a little bit lighter. I realized that, like, it took a lot out of me to do those episodes, to kind of have those intense conversations. But when I realized, like, that the people who I was interviewing, like you said, they were kind of giving me these gifts, and I felt really, really responsible to do them justice and do their stories justice. And I mean, it was, exhausting physically and mentally. I wonder what it'll be like for you after kind of this first season, you know, hearing your first episode and hearing, knowing that that you worked on it for 6 months, you know, really hard, you know, emotional things to talk about. And I can tell that you put a monumental amount of work into that first episode.
I definitely wonder that too. But like I said, one a month. So for the next 11 episodes, I've already got people either recorded or scheduled for recording. And I guess just knowing who's on that roster, I'm kind of, you know, like it's all lined up. I'm mentally prepared for it. And you know what? Yeah. In 11 months, I can take a look back and maybe I will take a break. Maybe, yeah. You know, and I think that's okay too. I think that just charging ahead with this goal right now and having that objective in mind is like, that's what's pushing me.
Right.
You know,
well, you're also seeing results too. Like people are excited about it.
I think people have been wanting to have these kind of conversations for a long time. So, and I don't want to just have the podcast to be, you know, like the catalyst for these conversations. I want people to converse amongst each other, you know, so I'm definitely doing some brainstorming, trying to figure out, you know, how do I make this more engaging for people listening? So.
Falling down, picking up the pieces. Will you run around, hanging on for days? I don't mind being patient for a while. I don't mind being patient for some time. Will you all catch me?
Kathy has given a gift to the climbing and outdoor communities with her podcast and blog. She's creating content that pushes the boundaries and takes on subjects that people oftentimes avoid in our society. But she's also creating content that is relatable, funny, human, and inspiring. Basically, the complete package. So if you haven't checked out For the Love of Climbing yet, I suggest you do that. Right when you're done listening to my podcast, of course. You said goodbye. Before we ended our conversation, I wanted to talk more climbing with Kathy, and I figured a great place to start would be with her fixation on the often misunderstood off-width.
Opened up my eyes to the highway in the distance. No worries about tomorrow.
You had mentioned that you like love to climb wide cracks. Like, talk about that. Like, what do you like about off-widths?
You know, I don't know. I don't even know what I like about them. They're mean. They hurt. You never send. Yeah. I don't know. I think, you're sitting right across from me, so you can see, but I'm very small. I think I fit into wide cracks very differently than most of my friends.
You can cam your thigh into a off-width shake out.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, don't worry, anyone listening to this, I know what that feels like. I've climbed off-widths with 9-year-olds. I'm always like, oh, how'd you fit in there? But I think that the reason I started climbing them in the first place was because I had no idea how to climb them. And so to not know how to get to the top of something, like, it was like learning how to climb all over again, you know? And I had this thought, I'm like, man, what if I'm on my big wall and there's an off-width pitch and I don't want to be the person who says, I don't know how to climb that, so you take that pitch. Like I said, the whole reason I started climbing is because I wanted to be very self-sufficient. So I was like, no, I'm going to learn how to climb off-width. So, you know, long story short, I go out to the creek, I try to climb with some off-widths, I get my ass handed to me, and then that summer I went to Vitavu and I try to climb all the off-widths, and I again get my ass handed to me, But then I go back to the creek that fall, and they weren't flared and shitty.
Yeah.
They were just splitter and, you know, just splitter wide cracks. And I was like, oh, I get it now. Yeah. So
how do you say, is it Vita Vu?
Yeah.
Those are like pretty stiff too, aren't they?
I mean, that's what they tell me.
They look hard.
Yeah.
They look really hard.
The texture there is the thing that's so hard. I mean, the flares too, but it's just on top of that, you have like this just, you know, crystal sharp,
right?
Yeah, rock sticking out. I mean, I only do the full palm wrap in Vita Vu.
Damn,
the only place.
Cool. What is your favorite kind of rock climbing? Like, if you could pick one,
man, I would just be like a single pitch cragger for the rest of my life. It's like the best. You can bring your dog. You can bring your snacks. I love multi-pitch climbing. In fact, so I'm here in Anchorage for the first time, and I went up to Hatcher's Pass. And so I've never climbed there before. I love climbing to new places. And maybe I just hadn't been multi-pitch climbing in a while. But I told my partner, Chris, yesterday, I said all day long I had this feeling that was super reminiscent to the first year that I started climbing, where I would finish a pitch and I would sit on the belay ledge and I would bring my partner up, and I was just filled with this warm fuzzy. I don't know how else to describe it, but it was my whole body. And I remember being up on, we climbed Toto, and I kept thinking that felt like the first time I'd gone climbing. And multi-pitch climbing, it's just, I don't know what it is, if it's the exposure or the fact that you get to, you know, view the world from this, you know, this height. It's just, yeah, there's something really special about it. It's definitely my favorite.
What are some things that you'd like to do climbing wise moving forward or in the future?
I'm actually gonna climb my first big wall this October with my girlfriend Sarah. So it's funny, actually, after Africa, I used that whole experience to aid solo my first wall by myself, which it was huge, because, you know, I didn't have anybody to rely on, right? Like, I had to figure it out myself. And so I did that last spring, and then Sarah and I are gonna go to the valley, and we're gonna do our first big wall together out there. We're allotting for like maybe 4 or 5 days. And I'm like, oh, I don't know how to big wall climb with a partner. I only know how to do it by myself, so hopefully it's easier and not harder.
Right on. Where did you go solo climbing?
I went to Zion. I did something out there. It was great.
What'd you climb?
I did Touchstone.
Sweet.
Yeah. I cried when I got to the top.
Yeah.
I didn't think I would be that emotional, but I got to the top and there was nobody there to high five. And I just sat there for like an hour because I just cried. It was a big moment for me.
Yeah. Well, I honestly think like Zion is... There's no place like Zion. It's stunningly beautiful. And I did a few trips there, and they were just like some of the best trips of my life. Yeah. I mean, just incredible. So I get it.
Yeah, Zion's definitely one of my favorite places.
It's so beautiful.
Sure. It's amazing because every time I go, and I'm usually there during peak season, there's never a line on anything I want to climb. And I want to climb some pretty classic things, I feel like. Yeah, it's not overcrowded. Wait, I mean, don't go there. It sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, God, it's just like the free climbing there too just looks incredible.
It's incredible. Yeah. I didn't free climb all of Touchstone just because I definitely got pretty scared on a couple of pitches by myself. But I free climbed most of it, but the other I just like pulled on gear. So I'll actually have to go back with a partner so I can do the whole thing.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're done. We got.
Hopefully that was okay.
It's gonna be great.
Okay.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you enjoyed Kathy's stories as much as I did, and I hope you can apply some of her climbing and life wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. Don't forget to check out Kathy's blog and podcast, For the Love of Climbing, which you can conveniently find at fortheloveofclimbing.com. Little bit of Fernline business. If you're looking for ways to support this show, make sure you leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you enjoy the tunes you hear, you can find more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.
Last night I was driving, thinking to myself, I was off in the distance, far away from everyone else. There was a light on the highway, showing me the way to a place in the country, a home where I could stay. That's one for the child living inside of me. That's two for the old man waiting to be free. I know it's hard when your life ain't got a spark. You gotta keep it together. So close to me. For a while I was looking, stumbling in the dark, till I saw you were out there waiting for my call. There was a time I was fearful, there was a time I was settled down. Now it's off to the races, I got my 2 feet on the ground. That's one for the child living inside of me.